CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I am Lorraine Chilvers. And Lee, if you'd like to thank our sponsors.
Absolutely. Today's show is brought to you by Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney as outstanding and excellent. Also, SAP Business by Design, a fully integrated business management software solution designed for small to mid-sized companies that want the benefits of large-scale business applications without the need for a large IT infrastructure. And Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And to start off this week's radio news, this month, CFO Magazine stated that CFO compensation is up and down like a yo-yo. There's no question that executive compensation is a very delicate topic these days, one that is garnering both intense regulation and scrutiny and increased shareholder control. According to this year's tally of CFO pay, finance chiefs are in an enviable position. They've got a good story to tell their investors about the austerity of compensation, even though they take home healthy paychecks. Viewed through one lens, it certainly appears that CFOs are working harder for what is essentially less compensation, said Deb Nielsen, director of executive compensation at salary.com. Thanks to marked declines in the long value of incentive stock and option award packages, total direct compensation is down a whopping 21% as a median for the top 30 paid CFOs, according to salary.com. And that's on top of the already steep cuts to salaries and bonuses that CFOs endured the year before when the financial crisis was in full swing. Then again, CFO salaries and bonuses are up, some dramatically over the last year, making finance professionals the winners on that front compared with all other white-collar positions. So for those of you who are interested in a finance career, go get it because you're going to be on the top of the salary range. And I am thrilled today to have Jane Fonda and Michelle Azumba joining us to discuss the nonprofit organization GCAP, the Georgia Campaign for Adolescent Pregnancy Prevention, and to discuss financing and fundraising as it relates to nonprofit organizations. Jane, you are founder and board chair of GCAP. Michelle, you are executive director and act as the chief financial officer at GCAP, a leader in its mission to support the youth of today and to prevent unwanted pregnancies. Welcome to the show, Jane and Michelle.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to talk with you this morning.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, Jane, let's start with you. Well, I must say, on a personal level, you broke my heart as well as made me laugh as the lovely new bride to Robert Redford and Barefoot in the Park. I always wanted to be his bride. You beat me to it. I will say I'm thrilled to discuss a very important and another aspect of your life. Many of the listeners today may not know you for the work that you've done with the United Nations and with GCAP. Not only are you an internationally renowned actress, having won Oscars, Emmy, and many other awards, you very much are a philanthropist. Let's start at the beginning, 1995. Why did you found this organization?
Well, I was married to Ted Turner, who had a family foundation that focused on population and the environment. So I was very interested in population stabilization as an environmentalist. At that time, I went to Cairo, Egypt with the UN Population Fund. I was the Goodwill Ambassador. And it was while I was there that really my understanding of the issue of girls and women having babies when they shouldn't when they were too young or too poor, unable to raise families, I discovered a lot of it had to do with social disempowerment of women and girls, the sense, especially among girls, that there was no future beyond having babies. At that time, Georgia had the highest rate of teen pregnancies in the country. And I came away from that conference back to Georgia determined to try to implement what I had learned in Cairo in my home state, and that was 16 years ago, something like that.
Yes, yeah.
We've learned a lot subsequently. I met Michelle when she was working, how do you call the department that you worked in, Michelle?
Public Health.
Mm-hmm. She had started the network of teen centers around the state. It was very important work, and now she runs the Georgia Campaign for Adolescent Pregnancy Prevention. We've, together with other organizations, and we're the only statewide organization that focuses on the issue of adolescent pregnancy prevention, but we work very much in partnership with many other organizations in Georgia, and the rates have dropped. We're no longer number one, but we still can't be too proud. We're 10. Is that correct,
yes.
Michelle? Are we?
Yes.
But
we're 10 highest.
It's still a huge problem because it prevents young lives from being as happy and productive as they could be, because it's very difficult to take advantage of opportunities that come along when you're a child and you have a child. It's also costs the state a lot of money to try to help and support these young children. So we have stepped in both to try to prevent the first pregnancy, but also, and this is a very important problem in Georgia, to try to prevent those young people who have a child when they're still children from having that second child. You know, if you have more children when you're not even 20 years old, it becomes very, very difficult. And so we work on both levels in many different kinds of areas.
And I read, Jane, in doing some history and learning about GCAP for today's show, that you had some very personal and perhaps emotional sides of learning about what essentially is quite a tragedy at the very beginning of somebody's life. How young are these girls that are in this situation?
Well, I mean, we have had girls as young as 10. Now, when a 10-year-old girl gives birth, it's going to be likely that the child will be underweight, and there'll be all kinds of health problems, not to mention what it does to the mother. What is the average age of the girls that we deal with, Michelle?
15, 16 is the average
yeah.
age. But so we have had the very youngs, and they're rare, but they are the most tragic.
Dramatic.
And obviously, yeah. From the work that I do personally through organizations affiliated with the UN, I know that a key element to a young girl's life is access to education. Are these young girls now at a situation where they can't go to school?
It's very difficult for them to go to school and be a parent. One of our wonderful programs are called Second Chance Homes. These are places where girls who are pregnant or have just had a baby can come and live. They're like homes more than residential institutions, 5 or 6 beds to a home with a very caring adult staff. They learn how to be good parents. They learn how to take care of their child. They also, we require them to go to school and graduate high school. Many of them go on to college or tech school. And these are all over the state of Georgia, and they're a really fantastic program, because what it does is it shows these young girls what it takes to really be a parent. You know, a lot of them have never had proper parenting themselves, so they don't know what it looks like and what it feels like. When they begin to learn what goes into being a good parent, they tend to not want to have a second child. So second pregnancies drop, child abuse drops, substance abuse drops. And anyway, it's a program that we're very, very, very proud of, and we get a lot of support from the state and from the federal government.
Well, Jane, you mentioned the homes and being able to house these young girls and now their newborn baby. What are the main challenges to the children and the families that you support? Is it monetary, or is it as broader and more emotional aspects?
Michelle, would you
sure.
would you answer that correct question? I just got a little
sure. The I think the most challenging aspect is the emotional development, the social-emotional development of the young women, because in our residential program that Jane just described, many of these young women have been in the foster care system, have had multiple placements before they get to ours, and so when we do focus groups with them and talk with them, this what they value most is the safety and stability that our program provides. Because we've had girls come from as many as 5-7 different placements, and they're just 15 years old. So when you have experienced that as a young child, your emotional state is really very fragile. And so you have to really do a lot of work, a lot of counseling, so that they can get some confidence and be able to, carry on in school, do the normal things, and really get to a point of strength that they can sort of go through their adolescence and parenting and have some opportunity for success, successfully completing that.
And Jane, you mentioned some of the programs. One might argue that there might be some 20, 30, and 40-year-olds that perhaps could benefit from learning to be a parent and going through your programs.
Yeah, including myself. it has nothing really to do with class or race or age. It's just that when you're older, there's more, you have more ability to access assistance. And so, a lot of these girls have never in their lives had a solid, trusting relationship with an adult. A primary attachment is what the psychologists call it. And that's critical for the development of a human being, a primary attachment. Another one of our programs which creates that primary attachment is called the Doula Project, where we match a woman from the community with a girl of her same ethnicity. And this woman, who we train intensively for 4 months, pay them while they're being trained. We then match them with the girl, and they help her go through her pregnancy, go through the birth, and then stay in touch with her after she gives birth to help her understand what it means to be a parent. It's one of my favorite programs. I would love before I die for it to be embedded in the WIC program, which provides nutrition for mothers and infants. And it's a growing program that we've brought to Georgia that's really very, very, very moving, because it's a win-win. It's a win for the woman in the community who has a job helping ensure a successful future for young people. It's a win for the girl who develops a trusting relationship with that adult. And it's a win for the child who benefits from having a young mother who now understands what it means to be a mother.
I can only understand. When I was 10, 12, 14, I was trying to figure out what pair of shoes would look nice with my little skirt that I had on. Heaven forbid, I can't even imagine trying to deal with another human in my arms. I, quite frankly, I don't know that I would have been able to cope. And a lot of this, I think, perhaps maybe coping skills?
Sure. Yes, I mean,
coping with stress. I mean, we're talking poverty. That's at the root of a lot of the problem, because if you look at the pockets of adolescent pregnancy in the United States, it corresponds with pockets of poverty. Middle-class girls have a motivation to avoid getting pregnant. If you're poor and you see no future for yourself, why not have a baby? At least it's something that will belong to you, that will love you. And that's why we say that hope is the best contraceptive. We try to show these young people that there is a future for them. There's a home in their future. There's a college in their future. There's a job in their future, hopefully. There's things that middle-class people take for granted that these children have never experienced. We try to show them that if they do stay in school and become educated, that, they have these things to look forward to. And that can be a motivation to keep them from wanting to get pregnant again.
Well, Jane, you mentioned the WIC program. Could either you or Michelle expand a little bit on there?
Well, WIC is a federal program that was created back in the days of the poverty movement in the 70s, 60s, late 60s.
It's
women and children. Women, infants, and children, and we know from the data here in Georgia that 97% of pregnant teens find themselves at a WIC clinic to get nutrition support, There's breastfeeding counseling, formula, although we really believe in breastfeeding in our doula project. We're showing almost 70% of our young teen moms are attaching for breastfeeding after birth. So almost every teen who's pregnant is going to find herself at a WIC, we think that that's a really alignment of where a doula can be assigned to a young pregnant mom to assure that she's going to take care of her prenatal health, get some good support to begin identifying and bonding with her child even before it's born, and then have that support following the birth for several months, so that the real focus here is to create that relationship. In the work that Jane and I discovered together when we went out to Chicago to meet the first community-based doula project, it was really the relationships that are transformational. And that's what our project is based on. And we're seeing it even in the data for our project here in Atlanta, where we're having tremendous positive health outcomes for the mother and the baby at birth. We're saving about $14,000 per birth with assisted by a doula, because there are fewer C-sections, fewer epidurals, and just all around better health status of the mom, because she's worked with this doula through her pregnancy to delivery.
How fabulous. And of course,
Lorraine, because you deal with financial matters, it would be great. Michelle, could you talk about what it saves the state by reducing teen pregnancy?
Well, in 2004 alone, we saved the state $224 million based on the rate of prevention that year alone. So there's a huge rationale, economic reason for investing in prevention.
You just said $224 million.
Yes, in 1 year alone. And if you factor in the cost of Medicaid, the WIC, food stamps, public assistance, cash assistance, and all the other consequences that we know that are resulting from teen childbearing, there's a huge economic factor that's often overlooked. And, you know, it's really is an economic proposition. Mm-hmm. You pay now or pay later. Mm-hmm. And we believe that if it takes a really sustained, significant investment in this issue to that everyone benefits from, everyone in our community.
Well, Jane, when we have nonprofit organizations on the show, I always like to allow you some time to very candidly give a plug. We are a finance radio show, and I'd like to give you a plug for what is at the core of nonprofits, and that is fundraising. And I think you've got something coming up that you'd like to talk about.
Yes, we do, and it's a party we have every year that is. It's sponsored by IKEA, wonderful IKEA, and it's called It's About Time. Celebrities, artists create clocks, IKEA clocks, turn them into works of art that are auctioned off on behalf of our Second Chance Homes program, the one I just mentioned, where we create homes where young girls who are pregnant or have just had a baby can live until they're ready to be on their own. This is taking place October 26th at 7 o'clock at IKEA in Atlantic Station.
And can people just turn up, or do they need to register?
They can register online. They can buy tickets online at our website, www.gcap.org.
GCAPP.org. Tickets are $75. And some of the people that have made clocks is Sidney Poitier, Tyler Perry, Ludacris, Queen Latifah, Venus Williams.
And CFO Radio is about to.
Huh?
And CFO Radio is a sponsor we're about to as well. I think ours is going to involve some kind of a finance or a calculator. I'm not quite sure. But
that's great.
We got a wonderful designer putting his head together for that.
Thank you. That's great. We'll have a money clock.
That's just great. It's a lot of fun. It's a wonderful event. People always have a very good time, wonderful drinks and food and a lively auction.
And will you be there,
clocks.
Jane?
Yes, I'll be there. I'm always there, yeah.
Wonderful. So a chance to see you in person and maybe a visit back to Georgia as well for you.
Oh, yeah. I come back to Georgia. I may not be living there right now, but my heart is there. My grandchildren are there, and I come back all the time.
Well, Jane, I would like to thank you very, very much. I understand you need to leave the show now. We will continue with Michelle. This has been an absolute pleasure on a personal level to have had you on the show. I'm definitely going to get back to you later about the whole Robert Redford thing.
We'll share secrets. Okay?
But thank you very much for being on our show.
Thank you, Lorraine, and I'll see you soon, Michelle.
Thank you. See you soon.
Bye.
Well, Michelle, we would like to continue with you, and we're going to be talking about finances related to the nonprofit world. Michelle, GCAP is a nonprofit. Just for purposes of discussion, because I'm one of those technical geeks, I assume you're a 501c3 charitable organization.
Yes, we are.
And we've talked about some of the services that you provide to the community of Georgia. Maybe let's start talking a little bit about you and your career. We always like to talk about if somebody would desire or aspire to be you 5, 10, 15, 20 years in their career, how should they go about it? So prior to joining GCAP, let me give you a little bit of background on you for our listeners. You were the director of the Office of Adolescent Health at the Georgia Division of Public Health. Under your leadership, Georgia established the state's first network of 27 community-based teen health clinics. Prior to that, you were a lecturer in urban planning at the University of Nigeria.
Yes.
And also a consultant to New Brunswick Tomorrow, a public-private redevelopment organization spearheaded by the Johnson & Johnson Corporation. So, Michelle, you're now here today at GCAP. You've been a lecturer. You've lived in Nigeria. What actually brought you to this position?
Well, I think oftentimes life is a journey, and it's not so much a conscientious pathway that I created, obviously, from city planning to Nigeria to public health. But I would say that my academic background has always had always focused on policy and public policy analysis, and it's really, really served me very well in all three of these arenas that you mentioned. So, I would say for anyone aspiring to get into the nonprofit arena, I think you can really there's no specific individual career training per se. I mean, there are lots of courses, obviously, on nonprofit management, but I think what has served me best is just the diversity of experience and having to work with so much a diversity of people from all different levels in all different sectors. That's really the training that has served me best.
And for purposes of our listeners today, it's important to note that you are president, CEO, and that you have probably a whole lot of hats, but one of your hats is to make sure that the finances are being led properly. Whether you have formally the title of treasurer or CFO, you manage multiple roles.
Yes, and in our organization, we really don't have a full-time CFO, so that is really how I serve. A lot of my time is devoted to financial management.
Well, let's see if we can get you some more fundraising, and then potentially you may need some more headcount.
Yes, very welcome.
Well, Michelle, the economy is tough. There's no getting around that. We've had a pretty substantial financial crisis. What is the greatest challenge to an organization such as yours, given the current economic climate?
The biggest challenge in terms of financial management in today's climate is having sustainable cash flow, having this kind of financial security that allows you to invest in highly talented staff and give them security, to keep the quality of your services, not compromise the quality of what you do, because ultimately the most important thing is our constituency, which are the young people and the families we serve. But a lot of the past 2 years has been spent trying to really figure out how to keep your donors engaged and satisfied. So it was, I think every nonprofit has struggled with that tension especially the past 2 years.
And obviously the donors are also embroiled in this financial insecurity that we're going through.
For sure. I mean, we have been privileged to have a lot of very generous individuals in our community here who've supported GCAP since the beginning of when we started. And in this environment, even the wealthiest are watching how they use their discretionary income. And even if you have it still, you don't want to flash it because it's just an environment and a perception. No one, and you want to be sensitive to what the average person is going through. So I think it calls for a lot of sensitivity to all the changes that we're experiencing and being a nimble organization that can react and, you know, and succeed in spite of it all.
You know, it's interesting. We've talked earlier with Jane and yourself in terms of this being a situation, perhaps poverty is a key element of what may be driving some of the outcomes of your clients that you serve. Being that we're in a pretty substantial economic down, do you anticipate child pregnancy age plus where we are? Do you expect 10, 12 years from now to have another boom, a lot of children coming out from today's recession?
We're working very hard to not have teen pregnancy be one of the indicators that goes up because of the recession. As you know, the poverty rate has increased. In Georgia, one out of every five children live in poverty. It's tremendously high. But we have a campaign where we're trying to achieve a 15% reduction by the year 2015. It's called 15 by 15. And you can go to the G-Power website, microsite attached to our website, and actually see a whole wonderful display of people who have put in $15 to support this campaign.
So that's all it is, $15.
$15, you can upload a video, a text message, a still photo, and just be part of a growing community of people who are committed to our cause and our mission, which is to eradicate adolescent pregnancy in our state.
And obviously there's a financial statewide impact based on the $224 million per year numbers that you quoted.
Sure. I mean,
could you have your next promo contribute to us and we'll save you taxes?
Well, we can talk about it. I don't know, you know. I think everyone has to try to be creative these days to make it all work and continue moving ahead.
Mm-hmm. Well, the role of the finance function and the CFO often focuses on cash flow. As an executive director and managing the finances for GCAP, how do you go about raising funds, fundraising, and my understanding is that you receive some grants as well. How does the process of grants and fundraising take place? Because we've probably got an awful lot of listeners, that don't realize what is involved.
Yes, well, it's very complex, and we have, I would say, our budget could be split a third from public funding, from state or federal funding, a third from private donors, and a third from foundations, private foundations. And so, and each of those sectors requires a whole different approach to be successful. So we have a small development team. We have a development director and her associate who do the prospecting, try to identify new opportunities. And the philanthropy world is changing so much, though, that what used to work a decade ago is no longer at work. It takes a year maybe to cultivate a relationship with a foundation. So you have to weigh that against your need for immediate cash, which tends to come from your individual donors. And then you need to develop those relationships to make it more than just asking someone for a check. They want to be, you know, respectful of their commitment to philanthropy and their cause. So that takes time and energy and different strategies to use there. And the government is highly competitive. You know, they're usually national requests, and so you're competing with thousands of others who are writing in. So you really have to have a really, really strong team that can write effectively and put in winning proposals.
How long does it take to put in a proposal for a grant and actually receiving the money, or alternatively receiving the notification that you've been declined?
Well, we just went through this whole new cycle, which is a great example. The RFA from the federal government came out in March, and the proposals were due by the end of June, and we just got the awards last week. So how many months is that? I can't do the math real
quick.
Quite
a few months.
Quite a few months. So you have to survive and hold on tight while you're waiting for that big win. Mm-hmm. And GCAP was lucky. We were one of eight state organizations to receive a $1.5 million grant award for each year over the next 5 years. So that's a huge investment. And other organizations in the state also were successful. So we have about $8 million as a state in new money coming into the state for teen pregnancy prevention. So it's a tremendous opportunity for us to make some high impact now.
And are there any local or state opportunities for that funding?
Yes, actually there will be grants that are coming to the state's agencies, which nonprofits like us cannot apply for, but what will happen is the state agencies will get the funds in the spring. By next June, there'll be another 1.7 coming to the Division of Family and Children's Service for teen pregnancy prevention, and those funds will focus on working with young people in the foster care system to prevent teen pregnancy. Girls in the foster care system are 2.5 times more likely to become pregnant as teens than a non-foster care youth, so there's a need for some focused attention there. And then there'll be another $1.8 million coming to the state for abstinence education. So there is an unprecedented opportunity in Georgia to reach a whole diversity of communities in need of specific strategies for prevention.
And you're the only statewide organization in Georgia providing this?
Yes. And nationally, there are about 15 GCAP-like organizations. So Georgia in the South, we have Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina. We have pretty strong state organizations, and we collaborate a lot because we have similar economies, similar populations, and so on.
Now, what about these major organizations that you've talked about who contribute to the likes of GCAP? Have they changed their focus in the recession times?
Well, yes. Actually, even prior to the recession, there's been a decrease in philanthropy to the social service sector, a significant decrease, actually, by about 12%. But there's been an increase in funding from foundations that goes to environmental causes, global causes. And so some of the larger foundations that typically had a very big role to play in domestic social welfare, they're looking global now. Your $10 in Africa goes a lot further than your $10 in Georgia. So the nonprofit sector really is grappling with that reality. And so it makes everything more competitive and more personal.
Yeah, interesting that you say that. Certainly we see an awful lot of highly publicized fundraising activities in the U.S. and the folks for whom that money will go towards to support are not in the U.S.
Yes, and I think there's beginning to be some discussion about it in the philanthropic world and in the nonprofit sector, because if you look at the increased lines of families in going to food banks, we have a serious hunger problem in our country. But I think because of our level of development, it's a very complicated system to navigate and to feel that immediate impact of your giving. Whereas in a third world country, it's less complicated. Your money really, you can see that and feel it very immediately because the needs are very, I won't say simple, but they're just less complex. It's mm-hmm. It's the basic, food, water, light, and clothing.
Sure.
And so here it's a challenge.
Well, the challenges that we're talking about, let's talk a little bit about some of the structural challenges for today's nonprofit. In other words, maybe the foundational aspects of the organization. Speak to us a little bit about that.
Well, you mean the way we're structured as a sector?
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because the nonprofit sector has really been, I wouldn't say pressured, but influenced and run sort of parallel to the private sector, for-profit sector. And for those in your audience, I'm sure are economists as well as CFOs, the Milton Friedman theory of the shareholder being the primary value, I think that has filtered over into our world where the donor is your primary constituency. And so there's lots more pressure on us to have opportunities for donors to be engaged in the mission and begin to see influence more deeply how their money is used compared to the professional staff that's in the trenches. And so I think there's some of that challenge that we face structurally in the field. But we have to learn from the private sector what to avoid, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. I think the focus on the value of the shareholder at the expense of customers and sort of a collective sense of social responsibility has cost our country tremendously. So I think that the nonprofit sector may be in a position to be the model now for how to contribute some value to the private sector. Maybe there's some lessons learned mm-hmm. because I think extreme in both directions is not effective. It's not the best strategy.
Mm-hmm. And obviously one of the structural elements that you have is that every dollar that a donor would contribute to your organization or any other 501c3, there are certain perhaps statistics or data measures. Perhaps you can talk a little bit about that, but there are measures that essentially rank the effectiveness of a nonprofit and the amount of that dollar contributed going towards internal costs of budgeting. I would maybe say something that perhaps some future guest or listener can correct me upon, but I'm guessing that many of the donors that you have today, if they were to be asked to create the same efficiency of reduction of costs to have their overheads be 3%, 5%, 12% of their organization, they probably would be challenged to do that within their own company, yet they hold that to you as an expectation.
Yes, that is such a great point, Lorraine, because in the nonprofit sector, I guess maybe it's the origin of the charitable sector of our society. It's almost seen as the next step above volunteerism, you know? And so here you have us dealing with some of the most challenging problems in our communities, which is behavior change. And you have the least investment in that. And I think the least value for the skills and level of expertise that's required to really be impactful. So I think we are held to a different standard. And when you're investing in your operations and administration, you're seen to be not good stewards of someone's money. And so I think if we're going to be held accountable to some of the same measures and standards of management as a for-profit firm, then I think we have there should be room for the nonprofit sector to be seen as professional. And we have to make those investments in talent and expertise and experience, just like you would if you were running a big 500 company. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because if you read the leadership and business books, Good to Great and all of those, you really see the cultures that are created because of those kinds of investments. And nonprofits are just, we're hangers-on, hanging by a thread too often. Mm-hmm. And the expectations are huge. The structures are fragile. And the turnover is great because young, smart people are going to look for the next best thing.
And the Who Moved My Cheese in Your World, to quote a very famous book, is probably who moved that check out the door and why didn't we get that grant?
Exactly.
All of a sudden, you're immediately thinking, what do we need to close down? How can we be more efficient?
And yes, our product is service, right? And just like in the private sector, there's been a lot of emphasis now on metrics and measures and results measurement. But in a field where we talked earlier about how important relationship is, we don't know how to put a number to that. But I know it has a tremendous value. So we are looking for new and creative ways to create metrics that really have a lot of integrity, show impact, and can influence us getting closer to our mission. And all of that is work still to be done. I think it's very exciting work because I do think we're facing, even if the economy improves, we want to really still take advantage of the opportunity that a crisis creates. You know, the word for opportunity, there are two characters in the Chinese alphabet for, I think, crises. And one is danger and the other is opportunity. So I like to think that GCAP is an organization has a great team of professionals. We've weathered the storm. We've secured a major grant right now, and so we're going to be able to take advantage of this crisis by looking to the future and figuring out what is it that we need to do to be the best organization going ahead.
Interesting that you use the term weather the storm. I often think of nonprofit organizations as being the barometer for for-profit companies. Nonprofits typically leave it until the last minute before they lay off headcount. The for-profit organizations are way ahead of them on that. They cut for the quarter.
Yes.
Nonprofit organizations often reflect the beginning uptick in the economy starting to pick up through private donations beginning to come back. So have you seen any aspects of your business reflect the economy in that same way?
Oh, yes. GCAP had to downsize tremendously last year. We actually downsized by nearly 50%. We took $1 million out of our budget, and we were watching our cash flow weekly up until last week when we got the grant. So it has really been a challenge to manage successfully through that, keep your core team that's really highly productive. And that's why I say a crisis can't be wasted if you really can muster what it takes to not give up, because we are very proud that we've held on to our best team, and it's paying off because we kind of took some tough decisions that needed to be taken.
And I'm sure you've let go of some great people too.
Of course we did. And that's always, if you're in leadership, that's the hardest thing to do. Because
maybe listening to the show Monday morning, they'll be calling you.
Well, you know, the smart thing is not to take this new money and and explode.
No,
that's what I mean, is you have to now say, what is the opportunity here to do something different and be successful at the same time?
Sure. Yeah. Well, Michelle, what about the economic condition of your clients? What have you seen occur with them in the last couple of years?
Well, the needs are increasing at the same time when resources have been decreasing. You know, we see children who have multiple generations of poverty. And that means that you're seeing a lot of young people who come from single female-headed households, which traditionally have much lower income than two-parent households. You're seeing the need to almost try to create a parallel family. You're not just coming in to do a vaccine or, you know, do a curricula. You really have to create this parallel family structure for them to begin to learn the norms of what you would give to your child in terms of confidence, love. Basically, it's really loving and respect and trying to, you know, let them make mistakes, but they can get up because they have a hand to help them up. And as the economy, you know, if you're at the bottom of the economic structure here, if the rest of the country is getting a cold, you're going to have pneumonia. So that's a lot of the families that we work with, those most in need. And you see that it's not just the individual young girl. It's her extended family, her siblings, we try to reconnect them with their birth families where it's appropriate, where there's not violence and abuse. That's still very important. So you have to work through all those relationships as well. And it's hard when there's unemployment in the family. Our girls coming out of Second Chance often become to represent the most stable person in the family, because she may have finished her. We still have young people who are the first generation high school graduates here in Georgia in 2010. And we've had many, many more than one be that example. So she gets an apartment. She may have a job. And so if the rest of her family has been fractured, she's the stability. But she still may be just 20 years old. So imagine the responsibility she has. And how do you manage that transition when that responsibility of all the stuff that you really can't handle is still coming to your doorstep? Because you're at 20, you're not going to tell your mother, you can't move in with me.
No,
or
absolutely.
Your younger brother can't come live with you.
And let's face it, at that stage, mother moving in with you may be a help to aid with your own child's growth.
Well, it could be a help, but it could also
be
too often it's a hindrance. Too often it's a hindrance, because the reason why she was homeless in the first place had a lot to do with what was happening in her family, right? So if there was a stable family, she wouldn't have been
in
GCAP.
Right.
So that's what we're struggling with, and that's why now the next challenge for us in our Second Chance is to build this network that can create a longer pipeline of support beyond high school.
So, well, I must say, Michelle, this has been an absolute pleasure spending time with you and Jane. I've learned an awful lot about an organization that's at home on my doorstep. And I have one final question. Being that you're the head of the finances for the organization, we've got a tradition on the show to ask your CFO tip of the month. What is yours?
My tip of the month would be to celebrate the wins when you get that big check, that windfall. But don't lose sight of the long term and the need to be a good steward of that windfall. and make it last a lot longer than it was intended to.
Well, that is a fabulous tip. I think for-profit organizations can benefit from that wise knowledge. Well, thank you to Jane Fonda and Michelle Ozumba for being our guests today and for sharing your innermost thoughts, not only on the role of the nonprofit, but of the role of finance in the nonprofit. Thank you also to our contributor and to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and fast-growing businesses and nonprofits alike. For more information, please go to DelaneyLLC.com. To SAP Business by Design, the software as a service business management solution for small and medium-sized companies. For more information on their products, go to SAP.com. And thanks also go out to Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and finance executives. Their website is financialexecutives.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are or know of another CFO who may potentially be a great guest on our show, please go to our website and make an application there. Thank you very much to our listeners for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off until next time.